Peter Ford. I was ambassador for this country in Bahrain and Syria after 30-odd years in the diplomatic service. And then I had a second career in the UN, and now I'm deputy leader of the Workers' Party.
So I know at the moment the Workers' Party is looking at this digital ID. Unfortunately, there's no MPs or councillors. But what about the attempt to stop young people looking at social media? This seems to be following the in the footsteps of the Australians. But what do you make of it?
Well, I personally, and the Workers' Party generally, are very much against it. I mean, Tony, it's obviously a cynical ploy by this Labour government, desperate to grab on to some policy that it thinks will be popular. Starmer wants to leave his legacy, and so this is being rushed in. Without much thought, although at the back of their minds there is a sinister, long-planned agenda, which is to insinuate more internet control generally into our lives. The key point is that there will need to be an age gateway introduced into the whole of social media. So if you and I want to go in future onto YouTube, we will have to prove that we are over 16 or 17 or 18, depending on what we want to do or see. This will require either facial recognition, so you'll have to surrender, obviously, your right to privacy in that respect, or some form of digital ID. And we know that the government from Tony Blair's days have had this huge ambition to control citizens by bringing in digital ID. This is just going to be a backdoor. The government are going to say, oh, it's not ours, it's the tech companies who are insisting on it. We're just helping to facilitate it by making optional digital ID. It is absolutely sinister. And we should be on our guard against it and resist it at every turn.
Well, look, back in the days of four TV channels, our mass media used to do it a different way. They would say that that there was what they called the watershed. At 9:30 in the evening, you wouldn't get any certain types of content before that. So obviously this is something which is needed to have a separation in media between adults and young people and children.
It won't work, Tony. This is proved already by the experiment in Australia, where 3/4 of kids who were previously on these platforms have now found ways to get back onto them. It doesn't work, and our government know that it doesn't work. There have been other experiments elsewhere in the world. But it's not about efficacy. It's about shoehorning in something that the government think will be popular and at the same time allow more government surveillance of and access, control over access to the internet. It won't work. What would work would be if the government did something a bit more difficult, but which would be more effective, and that is to prevail on these big tech companies to moderate their not just the content, but the methods that they use, the algorithms that are calculated to ensnare kids and to keep them doom scrolling. This is where the government should be acting. That would be much more effective. And that's what real experts say, including people like the Children's Commissioner.
You're asking for trouble with these tech companies trying to tell them what to do. They just ignore you. I mean, look at the recent suing of Sadiq Khan by Palantir. He said, "Oh, I don't think we should have this contract with Palantir," and so they're now taking him into court. So they just ignore what governments say, and if governments try to push them around, then they punish them in the courts.
And no, that's just defeatism, Tony. And the cases are very different here. There is massive public support for controlling some kind of media access by youngsters. The government, if it applied the screws to these tech companies, would find great public support and they would persevere. But they have an agenda here. They're just using excuses so that they can control us better. And they're also depriving young people of freedom. It's not a minor point that before you're 16, you are not a slave. You have rights to freedom and access to information. Okay, it may be gently guided in some ways, like movie classifications, but you have a fundamental freedom, and the government are taking that away from people, young people. It's also a very useful medium for young people. They learn a lot on TikTok. They'll tell you themselves. It's a big part of their education. This is going to be just whisked away from them with no immediate substitutes in prospect.
So, should children have the right to view pornography, violent pornography? Should they have the right to view snuff movies or satanic imagery, all this sort of thing?
Everybody should have the right. That doesn't mean that they're wise to do it. And this is what parents are for. We should not substitute the state for parents just because parents are lax in many cases, and unable to give proper guidance to their kids. It doesn't mean the whole of society should suffer loss of freedom.
But the whole point is the parents can't control what their children see on their phones.
But that I come back to the point that the government has to pressure the tech companies to curb their use of these algorithms and the website design aimed at keeping the kids doom scrolling and introducing them to strangers. It's about web design. It shouldn't be about freedom.
Is there a case, do you think, for more government intervention in technology? Because I can remember as a young man, the post office, all of that was, the telecommunications, telephones was all run by the government back in the 1960s, 70s, and even into the 80s.
Well, that's where we're headed back, if the state has anything to do with it. I mean, this is just a beginning. This is just social media banning for youngsters is just a first short step away from expansion. I mean, this is you don't have to be a prophet to foresee that there's going to be mission creep, and the next thing they'll be banning somebody else. I mean, this is a government that uses every opportunity to stop people getting information that the government don't like. Just a few days ago, an American journalist, Dan Kobilic, was stopped at Liverpool Airport. His crime? He was coming in to talk to a seminar about Eastern Europe. And Dan, I've shared platforms with him, is well known for being an objective commentator on Russia, Ukraine. The government don't like that, and so he was hauled over at Liverpool Airport. I think they used counter-terrorism powers. You cannot trust a government, especially a government like this one, authoritarian already. And in the wings, you have the authoritarians of the right. I mean, their historical track record is even worse than the left in terms of protecting personal freedoms. And we see already right-wing commentators welcoming this move. They're rubbing their hands in glee. They see how it can turn into a fascist state.
What can you tell us a bit more about this Liverpool airport guy, what he was stopped for, and whether he was detained, arrested, and how long he was held, and whether was he allowed to enter the country?
He was allowed into the country. I have only the most sketchy information, and this is breaking news for me. Just minutes ago, I caught up with it. But I think what happened to him is what's happened to a number of other journalists and politicians, including George Galloway, who in a few months ago was hauled over again using counter-terrorism powers and detained for several hours. You get your phone taken away. If you're lucky, you might get it back weeks later. It sounds like something similar happened to Dan Kovalik.
Yeah, so this is interesting, isn't it? These detentions are actually ordered by the head of counter-terrorism at the Metropolitan Police. He's the guy that makes the final decision. His name is Matt Dukes. Matt Dukes is also the chap who was involved in trying to get Palantir to spy on Metropolitan Police officers, and he is the one who's been working with this grandson of Oswald Mosley, who's now the British representative for Palantir, in suing Sadiq Khan. So all roads seem to lead to the Met, to this Assistant Commissioner Matt Dukes.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that, but I would be very surprised if these arrests were not personally authorized by the Home Secretary, or if not authorized, that she was made aware that they were happening before they happened. She, I feel fairly confident in saying, could have stepped in to prevent these detentions. Strictly speaking, they're not arrests because no charges are actually levied. No charges are made. The people concerned aren't actually accused of anything specific. They are merely detained. But the result is the same: intimidation, harassment, in some cases, people are driven into exile.
What about the general political situation? You mentioned the Home Secretary there. Many ministers are resigning, realizing that Keir Starmer's on the way out, and I suppose they could be described as leaving a sinking ship, and thinking that their time is better spent trying to manoeuvre for a position in the next government, which is going to be the same party, but no election is taking place over. The replacement of Starmer, which is extraordinary, really, with any political party is going to change its leader. One would expect, at the very least, an election about who that person is. But then there's also the political situation with this coronation, and the reasons. Why do you think Keir Starmer has been forced to resign?
Well, it's a culmination of many things, isn't it? On one level, it's simply the culmination of the Labour Party's failure on every front. They got off on the wrong foot, didn't they, with the winter fuel allowance, and it's just been one misstep after another. Starmer is just the scapegoat for all these missteps. And for mistakes made by other people like Ed Miliband, who's driving the deindustrialization drive very successfully, I must say. and the failures of the Treasury. Secondly, though, his personal qualities are what should we say, somewhat lacking. He's robotic, and he makes an easy fall guy. But I suspect that we'll only have to wait 6 months before his almost certain successor, Burnham, comes to be hated even more than Starmer and despised even more than Starmer. At least Starmer, most people thought that he was a fairly decent individual. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how Burnham measures up when he's clearly a chancer and a grifter.
What about the policies you mentioning there, the policy about deindustrialisation? Actually, Labour say they want more jobs, not less.
Well, that's a lie. That is a transparent lie. They're constantly promising more clean, green jobs. But on the contrary, we're seeing a decrease in the numbers of workers employed in industry. The way Labour government, Miliband and his team define green jobs would stagger you. It includes people like plumbers, people working in anybody working in the water industry counts as a green worker in their book. It's totally fraudulent. The reality is that entire swathes of industry are going to the wall over high energy costs driven by net zero regulation costs, general madness. Particularly industries, not just oil and gas, but energy-intensive industries like aluminium, cement, ceramics, petrochemicals, they're all going to the wall.
And what do you make of the Washington and Trump announcing the imminent departure of the Prime Minister Starmer 3.5 hours before Downing Street did last weekend?
Well, you don't know whether to laugh or cry, do you? I mean, you didn't have to be, again, a seer or a prophet to predict that Starmer was on the way out. And very often, things that Trump says don't turn out to be true. It was a case of wishful thinking. He wanted to see the back of Starmer. various reasons he didn't much like him, but though oddly he pulls his punches where the UK is concerned, whether it's because he has Scottish forebears or whether it's by political calculation isn't clear. But he doesn't miss Trump any opportunity to do down British politicians.
Well, he seems to be a great fan of King Charles III, who's one of the most unpopular kings here in Britain ever. Why do you think that is?
Because he's a fool, like many admirers of royalty, he's not alone in that. But while we're on the subject, can I just say how much it riles me to hear the monarchy described as a big financial asset to this country? That is a transparent lie. It's impossible for the monarchists to point to any financial benefit, apart from the number of tourists who go to Windsor and Buckingham Palace. And I've seen this as an ambassador when we had royals coming at the head of trade delegations. Anybody could have headed these delegations. There was no added value from the royals being involved. I had the dubious honor of receiving Prince Andrew, for heaven's sake. I've seen this at first hand. The royals are not a financial asset to this country. They're on the debit side of the ledger.
Oh, yeah, but looking at their finances, I think it's quite important to understand. They seem to be playing a sort of game here. Rob Evans at The Guardian has done for many years an excellent job in freedom of information requests and also being, you know, finding confidential sources who are giving him information about what when he was Prince Charles as well as now King Charles. Has had a sort of inner circle of people he circulates information to, a kind of little inner newsletter, and it's quite interesting getting that stuff published in The Guardian. Over the years, Rob's done that, and he's also done a successful load of freedom of information requests over the years. But now that's been blocked, the law's been changed, and people can't get any information out of royalty. It's all supposedly private. So I think we need to just look at the whole situation. Is the royal family at Charles and Camilla, are they a public institution or a private institution?
I think this is the wrong question to be asking, Tony, to be honest. I just can't get into this niggling over the millions that they cost. This is not the main issue. The issue is more fundamental. Should we have the monarchy at all? Not whether it should cost us 10 million or 20 million. Or are they squirreling away a few million for nefarious purposes on the side? That is a distraction. That distracts away from the main point. Is the monarchy helping this country? And I know that all these countries and leaders like Trump, who seem to be supporters of the British monarchy, they don't want it for themselves. No country except Spain, I think, has gone back to having a monarchy once they got rid of one. And Spain is a special case because their monarchy is now more like ours and being marginalized. And also, when the advocates of monarchy talk about them being part of Britain's soft power, that really gets under my skin because they can't point to any evidence other than the fact that Trump likes to shake hands with the royals. That how does that translate into power? It's ridiculous. Even thinking in those terms, either soft power or hard power, shows how pathetic we are. Successful countries don't talk about hard power or soft power. The most prosperous countries in Europe, like Austria, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, they don't talk about having soft power or hard power. They just get on with being prosperous.
We've also had, and it's a slightly weird period. It's like an interregnum at the moment with a resigned prime minister who's still making important speeches about Britain's policy on this, that, and everything else. And the latest one this week is all around defence. But the only trouble is there's a £5 billion hole in this budget that they've presented. They've no idea where this money is going to come from. What with the appointment by Burnham of this guy, is it James Purnell or Purcell or something, who's the former welfare minister who did lots of cuts in the past under the Gordon Brown government to the welfare bill? It seems that they're going to try and take money from the support which is needed for people in their housing and their food who have no other income to go on defence. So what do you make of this announcement this week?
Well, it's been a bit of a poison chalice that Starmer has left. On the one hand, he has brought forward this so-called defence investment plan. And by the way, investment is a misnaming of expenditure. It's not investment. An investment is something where you get money back, like in a bank account or an investment in a factory. You don't get any money back from defense. It's just all spending. It's a total misuse of the term, and it's meant to throw sand in our eyes of what's really going on.
Well,
It's
hang
a
on, because
handout from
what
the
if your
public.
army goes and takes over, say, a country with a big oil field? They're going to make money, aren't they?
It's an investment of taxpayer money that benefits the arms industry, who are the most effective lobby, and they lobby nakedly, openly. I was shocked to hear Lord Dannatt openly talking about the defense lobby, as he calls it, meaning the arms lobby, would go now even more onto the offensive. They are absolutely brazen about it. What they want is to get their sticky fingers deeper into our public pockets so that they can make even more money for the rich arms companies. But going back to your point, what this poison chalice, on the one hand, Starmer has helped his successor by parking the issue of total spending. This is now a ceiling. Whatever the hubbub and the uproar at the moment, very soon the discussion will be narrowed down just to where will the 5 billion come from? And that's why it's a poisoned chalice. Burnham will have to put the squeeze on a few departments. But he's lucky. Burnham is lucky. He can more or less park the defense issue now. And the one good thing you can say about him so far, so far, is that he hasn't said anything about defense or foreign policy. I dread to think what he will say when he does open up, but he is wisely keeping his trap shut on those subjects for the moment. But his choice of chief aide, the man you mentioned, happens to be, I think he was chair or very prominent in Labour Friends of Israel. I think that tells us a lot about him and about his master.
What do you think, though, about this idea that there's been no election at all within the Labour Party about Starmer's successor?
It's absolutely scandalous. I mean, if this was Russia and the Russians brought in somebody who wasn't even facing any kind of selection process, in meaningful selection process inside his own party, we'd be tearing them to bits and pointing out how undemocratic it was. But we're likely to find ourselves saddled with this charlatan who is all things to all men. We really don't have a clue what he would do. As a journalist said, he has more faces than Big Ben. And Big Ben is square, remember, with four clocks.
Well, we've also been told this week that we need to prepare for war with Russia in 2030. They believe that's when we will be at war with Russia. And there's been a massive investment in drone technology for these tech companies. So would you advise we put that in our diaries?
It's been absolutely outrageous how they are conditioning public opinion to expect war with Russia. They won't be happy until they get their war with Russia, will they? These people, the same as the American hawks who for years clamored for their war with Iran. Well, in the end, they got it, didn't they? And look what happened. The same thing is very likely to happen with us, only it will be far more dangerous because of geography. Russia can strike us only too easily, whereas America is thousands of miles away from Iran, so the potential harm is much greater. No, it's absolutely scandalous the way these pundits and talking heads take it for granted that we have to face down Russia and that there's likely to be war by 2030. When top people like Dan Jarvis, what a bonehead that man is. I mean, what is it about military people? Why are clowns drawn to this profession? I've known a lot of smart military people, but the ones who rise to the top are absolute boneheads.
Well, you can say, excuse me, you could say the same about journalism and politics and all sorts of other professions, Peter. So what's the potential war with Russia really all about then? I mean, I was hearing it from one of the defense analysts this week, was talking about the need for an increase in the defense budget to defend against Russia. That by 2030, we could even be seeing Russian soldiers going down our streets and raping our young women.
It's all about money. The lobby, the defense lobby, are simply using this specter of war by 2030 to rake in the millions and put pressure on the government to spend even more money. I mean, it's a bit ironic, but Starmer is absolutely right to point out that the government is already spending vastly more than previous governments. But does he get any thanks? No, on the contrary, the lobby come back and say, it's not enough. We want double that. It's all about money, but it's a very dangerous game because what is Russia to make of this? This is a question none of these boneheads ever ask. Well, how is Russia going to respond? Won't they get drawn into this rearmament game? Similar to what happened in the lead up to the First World War and the Second World War.
It's just about a year now since, sorry, 10 years since Brexit and the vote. Do you think it's been a success? Because people actually wanted, the main reason people said that they wanted it was for sovereignty, this idea that you can actually vote for people that are making decisions about you. Obviously, you can't really do that with Brussels, that the MEPs don't have very much power. All things in Brussels are decided by the Commission, who are not elected. So, how do you think the Brexit's gone 10 years on?
Well, the problem is not Brexit. It's how the politicians have used or failed to use Brexit. They've failed to make us truly independent in foreign policy from the EU. The main reason I personally supported Brexit was that I thought it would be impossible inside the EU to have an independent foreign policy. But now we've got the worst of both worlds. Although we have independence, we've chosen to follow the dictates of the German rulers of Europe. And we're among the leaders in Europe in making war on Russia, economic war, it's cyber war, information warfare. We are already effectively at war with Russia, and it's no surprise that they're retaliating. So it's not Brexit which is the problem, it's the politicians failing to use Brexit.
I hate to say it, Peter, but none of the things we've been talking about so far are what comes up on the doorsteps in places like Makerfield. The two main topics are one, the cost of living, and the other is immigration. So I wonder, do you think, what does the Workers' Party and you think about those two?
The cost of living it comes down. The main controllable component there is energy. Energy is fundamental to everything we do, everything we buy. And deliberately courting disaster with these net zero policies, we would stop that. The Workers' Party would bring that to an immediate halt, and that would bring immediate benefits in the cost of living. And we would see growth in industry and higher wages as a result. No other party is as clear-cut as the Workers' Party on that, although we might have hopes of reform in that respect. In immigration, well, the actually, I think this is a diminishing asset for reform. The government are getting on top of the small boats issue. Numbers are coming down considerably. I think a time will come when people, ordinary people, realize that this is not a key issue. This is not the main reason that they're suffering, and Farage will have to try harder on other fronts. And the other thing, sorry, just to be quite clear, the Workers' Party is very much against the racism involved in much of the discussion about immigration. And we're seeing on the part of the right, incipient anti-Muslim racism. They exploit any opportunity. You have only to open the Daily Mail any day of the week to realize what's afoot. This is very sinister.
Finally, we're here. There are rumours that Donald Trump is just about to resume the attacks on Iran. What do you think? What do you think? Do you think he'll do that? And how do you see that conflict going in the next 6 or 8 months?
Well, I hope and I think that Iran has America over a barrel here, almost literally. The Americans can huff and puff, but at the end of the day, they can't stop Iran blocking the Straits of Hormuz. They've tried it over an extended period, and they can't. It's geography. You know, we may have seen the end of history, but we've not seen, and we won't see the end of geography. It's 21 miles, the Straits of Hormuz, and it doesn't take a massive navy to store a big air force to block it. So, Iran has a trump card, if I can put it that way. The Americans will have to, and Trump personally. His future as president is on the line here, because if he does start the war up again in earnest, then we will see a world economic depression, and he will lose massively in the midterms in America. So he and it actually it would be quite easy for him to be a little bit diplomatic and cash in what gains there are still to be had on the table. He can claim that he brought Iran's nuclear power program to an end. That is definitely on the table. The most difficult issue is not issues between America and Iran or the Straits of Hormuz. It's Israel and Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon. And this is what Trump dreads, having to turn the screws on Israel. But it is implied in the 14-point agreement that the sovereignty of Lebanon must be respected. That is code for Israeli withdrawal. And if it doesn't happen, then Iran will close the straits. Simple as that. So I don't think, for all their huffing and puffing, the Americans have much choice.
Yeah, but Netanyahu is definitely not leaving southern Lebanon, is he? I mean, he's on a tour apparently the last couple of days. He himself has been strolling around this newly captured part of the greater Israel, and he has intentions of going north too. And at the same time, there is a Congress effort which has blocked the attempt to stop US and Israel military integration. So the US and the Israelis are becoming one military. So I wonder, this surely is going to drag on and on if the Israelis are able to say that when we're involved in a war that the Americans are too. This is going to be rather awkward for Trump to say no, we don't support that.
I don't think so, Tony. Look, back in history, Israel has, in the last few decades, twice withdrawn from bigger occupations of Lebanon than this. There's a pattern there. Secondly, the Israeli military is taking substantial losses as a result of its occupation of southern Lebanon. I think elements inside the IDF want out. They see no benefit in staying there. They've already wreaked enough damage. And thirdly, and most importantly, Trump will have to turn the screws. Otherwise, it will be the end of the US-Israel relationship, which would have untold long-term consequences. So I think the days are numbered for the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon.
What about this thing of integrating the two militaries, though? That mean that surely is a game changer for Netanyahu. He'll get his way.
No, because it's a very technical question, and there's resistance inside the American political system and inside the Pentagon. Ultimately, it just comes down to a bit of arm wrestling between the two presidents, the president and the prime minister of Israel. I wouldn't get too exercised about this. One military. I mean, to all intents and purposes, they're already one military. They share intelligence, they share virtually everything already. I think it's more cosmetic than real.
Okay, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tony.